All we've got for you today, folks, is an unending inspiration brought to you by Dr. Norman Doidge. Fast on the track of the neuroplasticity of the brain's research, his latest book is The Brain's Way of Healing. This is part two. Stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare. This is Tributaries.
Your neurons are firing in sync with the music. This has been demonstrated many times. There are cases where this happens with light and people prone to epilepsy. If you flash a strobe, even if it's a strobe or a flashing light on a television program, people prone to epilepsy can go into seizures. Again, this is called entrainment. And so we can influence the rhythm of firing, but we can also influence other aspects of firing because our senses are, in engineering terms, transducers. Transducers just convert energy of one form into energy of another form. So in the book, I have descriptions of the use of sound-based interventions to help autism, ADD, dyslexia, learning disorders, the use of electrical stimulation, very, very gentle electrical stimulation on the tongue, just enough, in fact, to make the tongue feel like it's being touched intensively, to diminish symptoms of multiple sclerosis, traumatic brain injury, even Parkinson's. Examples of the use of light to treat concussions and traumatic brain injuries, migraines. All basically shifting away from an invasive technology to doing something where you basically learn to speak the language of the brain, and because the brain is plastic, if you change the patterns of firing, you can actually change its structure and function in many situations.
Yes, and that exactly speaks to the problems with the new opiates.
Right. So it turns out that one of the reasons that people are so addicted to long-acting opiates, but also other drugs used for pain, is we had a pre-neuroplastic view of how the brain worked in terms of medications. Look, there's a history to this. The discovery of short-acting opiates, it's in some ways very ancient, is a wonderful, wonderful discovery to relieve human distress. A number of years ago, people started using opiates for longer and longer periods, and they noticed people were getting addicted to them. There was a great backlash against that. They made it hard for doctors to prescribe opiates. And then it was felt that that was unreasonable. And we started using long-acting opiates, or, drugs. You know, people know what those drugs are. And many people got addicted. Here's what's happening. Our bodies produce our own endogenous chemicals designed to help relieve pain. Probably when the switch goes off, as it went off in Moskowitz, or it went off in Ronald Reagan. Remember when he was shot? He just stood
yes.
there. He didn't look like he was in pain. And after he joked, you know, I'd been shot many times in the movies, and I always acted as though it hurt. But when I was really shot, I realized that sometimes it doesn't. So our body has gates and methods of turning off pain. Now, when you have a really bad pain, like a terminal cancer pain or something, it's very, very persistent. So what people did is they, even for acute pains, what we would do is give chemicals which very much look like the chemicals our own body produces to eliminate pain. But if the pain is very great and our body's techniques, untrained, don't seem to be able to deal with it, we want to give them acute opiates or something to relieve their misery. But as they gave more, with the invention of chronic opiates, they assumed that it would, you know, the more opiates in the system, the merrier. The idea was you would just sort of, our cells have receptor sites, which sort of are like little switches, and we would fill those sites with opiates that mimicked our body's opiates to relieve pain. But It turns out that the brain is neuroplastic, and it responds to what you do to it. And over time, the brain, as if the brain could talk, was saying, you know what, there's so many opiates around here, I don't have to be as sensitive, or responsive to them as I've been in the past. And so it would turn down its sensitivity. And when that happens and you're a patient, it means the only way to get the pain relief you were getting is to increase the dose. And when that happens, the brain says, boy, there's a lot of opiates floating around here, and it gets less sensitive. So the patient is basically having to have more and more opiates to get relief. So the doctor increases the dose, but they're less and less sensitive to them. And so even their own endogenous opiates aren't doing the job. So that they remain in pain, and now they're hooked on drugs, which have side effects. So opiate dependence is another part of the plasticity story. The thing that was so important about what Moskowitz understood, because he was just trying to help people relieve them from terrible, terrible pain syndromes, was just diminishing their opiates wouldn't solve the problem because they'd still be left with their pain. He had to be able to give them something instead of the opiates. And so these various neuroplastic techniques, he's got a website, it's called neuroplastics.com, so it's got an X on it. But, you know, this is described in detail in my book.
Yes.
But the point is, you can't just take the drugs away from a person without giving them some kind of relief. And that's the beauty of the neuroplastic techniques. You can actually give them something so that they need less medication or no medication.
In your book, you mention how Dr. Moskowitz wanted to know the laws of neuroplasticity. And my question right there is, if it's so neuroplastic, are there any rules? And are there new rules being noticed now that we're in the second generation of application and research?
I would say that, to my knowledge, the second generation is basically been to apply the laws discovered in the laws. I mean, we talk about laws of plasticity. That's also a metaphor. I mean, I don't know if anyone wrote a law where it's a metaphor from human culture to nature. But the ways that the recurring ways of influencing the brain, I don't think I've seen any major breakthroughs in terms of new, quote, laws. What I've seen is new applications where we take what we've learned about how the brain functions and just applied it more vigorously. If anything, I would say if there are new laws, I've tried to describe them in the stages of neuroplastic healing. They're not laws per se, but what I was able to do was, by being exposed to so many different neuroplastic treatments, for instance, there are five alone for traumatic brain injury, five new ones. I was trying to figure out, as a clinician, well, how do I sort out who needs which treatment? And what I found was that if I stood back from what I was seeing, there were arguably five different stages of neuroplastic healing. One of them has to do with helping general cellular health. This is where things like diet and even sleep come in. For instance, there's a recent discovery that during sleep, channels open up in your brain through which toxic waste products are released from the brain. So if you feel wretched because you don't get enough sleep and almost toxic, it's because you are somewhat toxic. Sleep's very important. You know, all these food sensitivities people are discovering, sensitivities to chemicals, that's where this comes in. The next stage is what I call neurostimulation. Because many of the circuits have gone dormant because of learned non-use, you have to find a way to turn them on. Thought can actually turn them on, but I talk about light, vibration, very mild forms of electricity, and movement to stimulate circuits. Sometimes that means that a person who's had a stroke can actually be helped by very subtle movements of their limbs. I describe a case of a girl who was born with brain damage, missing a third of her cerebellum. It was underfunctioning, and she was supposed to be institutionalized. And with Moshe Feldenkrais, who invented the Feldenkrais technique, was able to get her going, and then one of his students finished the therapy. Several of his students might have helped. To use stimulation and awareness of movement to actually trigger not only movement in this girl who could barely move, but actually stimulate her brain to do cognitive things. And the next stage is what I call neuromodulation. And many of these patients, they're hypersensitive to all sorts of things, and there's an imbalance between excitation of the neurons and inhibition of the neurons. And when they do these treatments, they often have their first good night's sleep in ages, and they can filter out unnecessary stimuli and attend to what they have to attend to. After the neuromodulation, they go for a period of relaxation, and then they go through a period of what I, borrowing a Feldenkrais term, called differentiation, where they can begin to learn again. So I think that this is new, the just to sort of putting it all together. And also, in my first book, I talked about a number of rare conditions, because that's how neuroplasticity came to light, or in labs. But in this book, I talk about very, very common concerns that people have. Can you use neuroplasticity to limit to the risk of dementia? And, you know, Parkinson's, learning disorders, all the other illnesses and conditions that I described are now being dealt with by neuroplasticians.
It's interesting how all of this is leaning into and using quite successfully, as you mentioned, the energetics, the light, the vibration, the touch. And so it is really drawing in alternative healthcare. Alternatives that now are being used and fed into the mainstream system. A lot of it is ancient knowledge, but also I think this is the kind of thing where people almost instinctually go.
Yes. One of the great tragedies, I believe, is that, you know, humanity's two great medical traditions have been so estranged from each other and mutually incomprehending of each other. Western medicine has been very, very good at analyzing problems, breaking things down. I mean, even the medical specialties, we break things down into a person who handles the heart, the lungs, the liver, the kidneys. You know, there are specialties for each of these organs. But again, in reality, we are all of these things working in a systems way. Eastern medicine and Western medicine has made, and Western science, really, has made spectacular progress in understanding the brain, including how it divides things up and how it works. Eastern medicine had the insight that Humpty Dumpty always has to be put back together again. And they understood that the mind is very, very important in healing. It's not everything. You know, you can't wish your way out of, you know, six broken bones, as far as I know. But it can be used to affect the functioning of the immune system and the nervous system. And by the way, even those two systems are not completely separate in reality. And it can be used in other ways. It can be used to trigger certain healing responses in general for the body. And they also, although they did not understand or make use of the word brain very much, and there are even exceptions to that, but they understood that energy was important. When I was younger, I had some patients who talked about doing alternative things and energy-based things, and I'd say, well, how do they define energy in this practice? And they could never really give me a clear explanation. And I didn't know what to do with that. Maybe I was a bit dismissive at times, too. It's not that I wasn't interested. I just couldn't grasp it. Now, in this book, all of the energy-based interventions can be defined according to Western equations. But I do believe that it was because the people I'm describing, the neuroplasticians, were aware of these Eastern-based traditions and working with energy, that they were more open to pursuing this. You know, some of them were meditators. Some of them did martial arts. Some of them were involved. One of them grew up in Siberia and was knew a lot about acupuncture. So what I see is happening is, and I never would have anticipated in 1,000 years that I would be doing this, but focusing so much on energy. But what I believe this book is trying to do and is to show that there are bridges between Eastern traditional practices and cutting-edge Western neuroscience that go beyond, you know, the properly celebrated discoveries by people like Richard Davidson and Lazar, that, you know, Tibetan monks who, you know, meditated for 10,000 or 30,000 hours, you know, change their brain structures and improve their controls of their nervous systems. You know, that's really important work. Now I'm going into things like the role of visualization and energy to try to extend it. And it's, I really believe that the battle between complementary and mainstream medicine is at this point counterproductive. And, you know, each of them are excel in certain areas and could benefit from learning from the other in other areas.
Are they still studying the brain of a cadaver? I mean, when we look at the fact that it's, what, salts and water, what can they actually find in there when we're really acknowledging the energetics of what's really behind all of this?
Well, I mean, you know, that's, by the way, a very important question because, you know, when we didn't have brain scans or various, and I use that very broadly to include EEGs and all sorts, all the various tech windows we have onto the brain. You know, often all that we could do in the middle of the 19th century was, if someone died and they seemed to have mental symptoms, was look at their brain after they were dead. And here you're looking at a static brain. We could still see things. Important observations were made. A tumor is, a man couldn't speak and he had a huge stroke in the his left frontal lobe. Those were huge advances. But now that we have all of these brain scans, we can actually look not at the living brain. I want to say that because people always say that, and even I say that, but it's not quite right. We have windows into aspects of the living brain. I mean, we've never seen a thought with a brain scan. We've seen different people thinking in different areas of activation. We're not peering into subjective experience. It's easy to get seduced into thinking that we've solved that problem. We haven't cracked the neural code. We don't yet know exactly how thought emanates from or changes physical structure. We know that it happens. We don't know how it happens. There are unsolved problems. But nonetheless, these brain scans are spectacular advances in helping us to get maps of, you know, activities. And so the use of, you know, dead human tissue is relatively not nearly as important as it was. However, there are times when you can learn a lot about the chemistry of the brain by looking at dead tissue or, you know, I believe aspects of genetics by looking at that kind of tissue. There's still some role for that. But, you know, thank goodness we've, you know, got many, many more windows. And my technique in the book is never to look at just any one thing. I've just always felt that when you're dealing with very complex systems, it's important to remember that the scans or the physical exam or even subjective experience, all of these things have great strengths and limitations. I mean, asking a person, you know, who, I don't know, can't remember a word, well, why did you do that? Introspection will only get you so far. Sometimes it'll turn out to be they were emotionally upset in a kind of Freudian way, and sometimes it'll turn out that they've got early dementia, and they can't usually tell that from introspection. But the same limits apply to various brain scans. Some tell us which parts of the brain are active, but they don't tell us or which parts of the brain are most active, but they don't tell us about, I mean, just to give you an example, some mental events that we can, sorry, some brain events last about a thousandth of a second, like the firing of a neuron. And most of our current sort of brain scans that you see in the paper are at best measuring events that are lasting several seconds. Well, for all we know, the resolution required to sort of crack the neural code requires a thousandth or a ten thousandth of a second.
Yes. It's reminding me of how they used to call in the DNA junk DNA, and now they're calling it non-coding DNA because they found out that, well, this isn't exactly junk floating around here. It's what is distinguishing us from the chimpanzee, for instance. So all research leads, obviously, into more understanding and progress, I guess.
Yes, indeed. So, and when I say we haven't cracked the neural code, I mean, let me say what I mean by that, just with the metaphor of DNA. Look, people detected chromosomes and this incredible kind of, I don't know, square dance that they perform when cells are reproducing. But, you know, it took Watson and Crick and a couple of people they worked with to start to really break that code down. And we haven't done that yet. We know how to interfere with cognitive processing using magnetics or electricity or drugs. So that tells us by implication these things are probably interfering with processes that are electromagnetic and chemical. But we're not quite at the point where we can... We may get there, but we're not quite at the point where we can sort of form an exact electrical signal and, you know, determine what thought a person will have for the first time. We are at the point where we can, I don't know, take a person who can't move and get them to, I don't know, play with a robotic arm. Get them to imagine a movement and then sort of learn the electrical firing pattern of that particular movement and then feed that back to a robotic arm and get it to move in that way. But that's not quite cracking the neural code. That's not what we mean by that. Mm. So, but, you know, the ingenious thing in this book that is described is not the technology, the electronic ear, which is so helpful to, you know, children with psychiatric disorders, or the thing called the PONS, the portable neurostimulating modulating device, or the fact that certain lasers, low intensity lasers, which heal flesh set at certain frequencies in the 600s, can heal. It's that if the brain, when given a certain limited amount of accurate information, can often reorient itself and use that information to improve its functioning and regain lost functioning. That's how it works. So, you know, the brain is really infinitely more complex and able than we've thought it to be. If I could say a few words about the title of the book,
yes.
The Brain's Way of Healing. It was with some trepidation that I used those words because for about 100 years, doctors and scientists didn't use the word brain and healing in the same sentence. It was believed that the brain had evolved to be so sophisticated and so specialized to be able to process or contribute to thought that a price was paid and that it didn't heal like other organs. And in fact, we looked at the prognosis for brain problems and it was very poor. And we explained that in evolutionary terms, that it was the evolutionary price that was paid for the specialization required to produce mental experiences. So I said, can I call this healing? I looked at the word healing, and it comes from the Old English. It means healing, and it means not only to cure, it also means to make whole again. And these stories I tell of people with chronic pain or Parkinson's or MS or autism, etc., where people have been able to make improvements, regained lost functions, or developed functions that under a normal life course they would have been expected to develop. And that seems to me what people mean when they talk about healing. We've also discovered that the brain has its own unique way of healing. It doesn't heal the way other organs do. I mean, your skin has its a way of healing that's different from the way that the bones heal. Blood replenishes itself, you know, with new red blood cells that come from stem cells. The brain's way of healing involves the formation and unformation or reformation of new circuits very, very frequently in the course of our lives, and even in some small areas that are important, like the hippocampus, which turns short-term memories into long-term memories, the formation of new cells, which were only discovered in 1998. So if we keep in mind that different organs heal in different ways, I think we can argue that the brain can heal. Now, just because the bones can heal or the skin can heal or the blood can replenish itself doesn't mean that there are not situations where blood loss is so extreme, fractures are so multiple, you know, burns are so extensive that the body can always heal it by itself. Just because the potential for healing is there doesn't mean that all situations will heal. But it does mean that we have a path, and if we understand how these things work, we can midwife this process and help it along in many, many situations that we thought people couldn't be helped. And one patient after another in this book were told that they couldn't get better. And I have almost 100 stories of people who did improve.
They did, yes. Well, Norman, reading your book for me is a healing experience. I mean, literally reading, well, I got turned on by science things, but just reading about these folks you just mentioned did get so much relief and full-on healing, many of them, that there were endorphin gates that opened while reading this book. It's a true inspiration about possibility and actually love overall.
Well, thank you very much. That's very moving to hear, because I in the process of meeting these people and watching what they had been through, and many of them, again, had been disabled for years, and getting to know, you know, their struggles and their despair, and the fact that people were telling them that nothing could be done, and having seen them just try one thing after another and then finally benefit, and of course the scientists and the clinicians who have worked so hard, I found them to be often heroic individuals, both the patients and the clinicians. And I'm just so glad that they were able to find each other.
It's all part of the 100th monkey. Once it starts happening, we're just going to see it magnified.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
A wonderful, wonderful read. Quite inspirational. And you'll even learn a thing or two. The Brain's Way of Healing by Dr. Norman Doidge. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting on iTunes is at Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.